From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, over 170 people have now died in Gaza as Israel takes its military operation against Hamas militants into an eighth day.
No country can accept rocket fire aimed at civilians. And that's the reason that we support Israel's right to defend itself.
Also today, we look at the state of the rescue mission for hundreds of Nigerian schoolgirls, 3 months after their abduction by extremists. And one of South Africa's greatest writers, Nadine Gordimer, dies at the age of 90.
It was unthinkable for me to meet or know black people who would share my interests, with whom, in other words, there could be some sort of natural rapport and meeting.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts. Ukraine says one of its military transport planes was shot down in the east of the country amid clashes with pro-Russian separatists. The plane was hit with a missile more powerful than a shoulder-carried one, which was, according to Ukrainian reports, probably fired from Russia. NATO has also reported a Russian troop build-up near the Ukrainian border. The White House has expressed its ongoing concern.
There's still a lot of violence there. There's still indications that the Russians haven't taken the necessary steps to close off the border, that there are still heavy weapons and materiel that's being provided from the Russian side over to pro-Russian separatists on the Ukrainian side. There continue to be concerns about whether or not President Putin is actually using the influence he has with those pro-Russian separatists to encourage them to abide by a ceasefire agreement.
Israel's military said on Monday that it had shot down a drone along its southern coastline. The drone reportedly came from Gaza and was shot down by a Patriot surface-to-air missile. The military wing of the Palestinian militant group Hamas has claimed it sent homemade drones over Israel. Israel has yet to comment. The wrecked cruise ship Costa Concordia successfully floated about 30 metres on Monday as salvage workers slowly raise it above the water. The salvage team says the riskiest moment is over, as they had feared the boat could split apart when it floated away from its underwater platform. The refloating is expected to take 6 or 7 days, as Elena Casas reports from Rome.
The Costa Concordia's weed-covered hull slowly emerged from the sea on Monday as salvage teams pumped compressed air into tanks tied to its sides. It rose about a metre off its underwater platform and floated free, to the relief of workers who feared the rusty wreck could break apart. The ship contains hundreds of gallons of oil that would cause an environmental disaster if they leaked into the pristine marine reserve around the island of Giglio. The wreck was then tugged 30 metres away from the coast. This is just the first step in a refloating operation that's expected to take 6 or 7 days and cost €1.5 million before the liner can be towed back to its home port of Genoa for scrap. Elena Casas, Rome.
The Church of England's ruling General Synod has voted to allow women to become bishops for the first time in its history. A previous attempt to pass the measure was voted down in 2012. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, had said the exclusion of women from the Church's senior posts was incomprehensible to the general public. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Officials from the US Department of Defense are reported as saying that an American soldier held by the Taliban for 5 years is set to return to active duty this week. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl was released 6 weeks ago in exchange for 5 senior Taliban detainees and has been undergoing therapy in Texas. Our US correspondent Lorna Shaddock reports.
28-year-old Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has spent the last 6 weeks being given counselling at an army hospital in San Antonio, during which he was also participating in debriefs about his time as a prisoner of the Taliban in Afghanistan. But officials say he's now ready to assume a job on the same base at Army North Headquarters. This, they add, is part of Bergdahl's reintegration into army life, and he'll be living in barracks alongside other soldiers. Bergdahl's release on the 31st of May came as part of a controversial prisoner swap that saw 5 Taliban detainees handed over to the government of Qatar. Major General Kenneth Dahl has been assigned to investigate Bergdahl's disappearance from his outpost in Afghanistan back in 2009, amid claims that he walked away of his own free will. But up until now, the army has said that investigation would wait until Bergdahl's health had improved. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
In earnings released for the second quarter, American banking giant Citigroup has announced a profit of $181 million, down from over $4 billion last year. This comes after the bank reached a settlement with the U.S. Justice Department over allegations it sold subprime mortgages in the run-up to the financial crisis. The Nobel Prize-winning author Nadine Gordimer has died at her home in South Africa at the age of 90. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1991 in recognition of her enormous contribution to telling the story of South Africa's struggle against apartheid. In more than 30 novels, she gave voice to the iniquities of whites' minority rule. And she was also honoured with a Booker Prize in 1974. And that's the latest world news from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Over 170 people have now died in Gaza as Israel takes its military operation against Hamas militants into an eighth day. The United Nations say 17,000 Palestinians have sought refuge as Israel continues its airstrikes in response to Hamas rocket fire. A Palestinian drone was also reportedly downed as part of the IDF's offensive. White House spokesman Josh Earnest repeated a call to Hamas to stop launching attacks against Israel, insisting the country has a right to defend itself against militant aggression.
We have articulated our concern about the casualties that have been sustained on both sides over the last several weeks. We have concern about the casualties sustained by civilians on the Palestinian side as well. That's why we're encouraging both sides to exhibit as much restraint as possible. But we do that with the full knowledge that it is completely unacceptable for rockets to continue to be fired from Palestinian territory aimed squarely at Israeli civilians.
Krista Case Bryant is Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor.
Over the weekend, Hamas threatened to hit Tel Aviv, which they did quite thoroughly, although there were no deaths, and I didn't even hear of any major injuries. But there have been several Israeli injuries that were fairly serious in the past couple of days. And today, the number of Hamas rocket attacks on Israel crossed the 1,000 mark. And Israel also, of course, stepped up its airstrikes in Gaza, and it's now hit more than 1,400 targets, and there are more than 175 Palestinians who have been killed. And the percentage of those who are civilians has ranged widely depending on who's counting, but I've seen as high as 80% from the UN. So it is a very devastating situation, and colleagues of mine who have been in Gaza said it feels even worse than the last conflict in 2012. And I think there's more than 1,000 Palestinians who have been injured as well.
And there were reports of a small ground incursion by Israeli military forces targeting a Hamas facility. That obviously is feeding into this conversation about a full-out ground invasion.
Yes, there's a lot of speculation about whether Israel will launch a ground invasion. There's a significant amount of public pressure for that, as well as political pressure on Netanyahu from some of the more right-wing ministers in his cabinet. And I think we'll see a decision in the next few days here. There's been 38,000 reservists called up, and they're actually replacing a lot of regular service soldiers who were stationed in the Central Command and the Northern Command in order to free up those soldiers to be ready on the Gaza border. But I don't know. I'm not inside the IDF's head, but it seems to me that if there were to be any sort of ground offensive, it would be fairly measured and maybe just a number of pinprick operations like we saw already with the incursion that you mentioned, or some focus along the Gaza border and try to eliminate any tunnels that have been created that could be used in the future to launch attacks directly on Israel.
And part of that is Israeli military operation, they say, involved the downing of a drone. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, the IDF spokesperson said this morning that they tracked the drone from the time that it took off in Gaza, and they shot it down with a Patriot missile near Ashdod. Hamas has claimed that it sent something like 6 drones, including one that was hovering over the Kiryat, which is the head of the Ministry of Defense, or the headquarters for the Ministry of Defense. I think it's probably more propaganda than reality, since I don't think that the Ministry of Defense would tolerate something like that, and Hamas has made other claims that have not been substantiated by evidence on the ground. But I think it's certainly something Israel's keeping an eye on.
And Krista, we've been focusing mainly on those hard statistics involving that growing death toll, the number of injured, and the exchange of airstrikes, and of course the rocket fire from Hamas. But I know that you've been talking to parents on both sides of this conflict, and you've been hearing how it's been affecting children caught up in this.
Yes, I've been working on a story about the kinds of questions that parents are asking, or that kids are asking their parents, and how parents respond. You know, of course, if you're a political leader, you have sort of a clear narrative that you've rehearsed and that you either believe firmly or feel strongly that that's what you need to stick with. But when you're a parent and you have these very inquisitive children asking really hard, I mean, simple but hard questions about what's going on, you know, can be challenging to answer them. So some of the things I've heard from parents on either side are, you know, why are they shooting at us? That's the most common question. And also, are we going to die? And are the Israelis going to come and kill us, you know, on the Gaza side? And, you know, what happens when we do die? Will it hurt if a rocket hits us or not? Or will we just die painlessly? And will we be a martyr? Will we get to go to paradise? What will be in paradise? And is God protecting us? If God loves us, then why is he doing this to us? You know, so a lot of really tough questions for parents to be addressing. But there are also just some really touching moments of humanity. Like this morning, I was in Ashkelon in the yard of a family who had already had 8 air raid sirens go off this morning. And as the mother was talking, you could hear more loud thumps in the sky. And her little daughter was gripping her arm, and somebody asked her, you know, what would you say to Palestinian mothers in Gaza? And she just said, my heart goes out to them. She said she prays for their safety and their children's safety every day, and that she wishes the best for them, and just to be able to be a mom enjoying her child. And, you know, she lives just 5 miles from the Gaza border, and yet can't visit with any of those mothers over there because Israeli citizens have not been allowed to enter Gaza since 2005, since the withdrawal. But amid all of the war and the fighting and everything, there are still really touching examples of shared humanity like that.
Krista Case Bryant, Israel Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This is FSN Reports. As Nigeria marks 3 months since Islamist extremists kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls from the country's northeast, the female rights activist Malala Yousafzai added her voice to the calls for their safe return. 17-year-old Malala, who survived a violent attack by Pakistan's Taliban 2 years ago, met with President Goodluck Jonathan amid strong criticism for the Nigerian government's handling of the abductions. Boko Haram, the extremist group responsible, have called for the release of Islamist fighters in exchange for the teenagers. Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso, is in Nigeria.
Exactly 90 days or 3 months to the day that those number of just upward from 200 girls were abducted from Chibok. The number is anything between 219 and 226 officially, although it's not been officially confirmed on either side. The Nigerian government say 219, and the Boko Haram leader, Abubakar Shekau, says 226. So the number not exactly clear, but one can say that after 90 days, it's perhaps looking a little bit more desperate, and the Nigerian authorities not sharing a lot of information about exactly what they are doing as far as finding these girls are concerned. We know that there are US, Israeli and French intelligence groups assisting in Borno State, the northeastern part of Nigeria. So we know that there's lots of intelligence and lots of surveillance of the area going on, but no formal progress being made in finding these girls.
Gary, can I ask you about Malala Yousafzai? Because she's been meeting with President Jonathan. She, of course, is that the female rights activist. What was her message to the leader, and did anything come of it?
Well, yes, it's quite clear that the young Malala's visit has had some impact. She met with him at his presidential home with President Goodluck Jonathan in Abuja today, and it was very clear that the young activist has not only a message of the world wanting Nigeria to resolve these problems and bring the girls back, but to find a negotiated settlement and do whatever it takes. So a very positive message, and perhaps again put the spotlight after much sort of international sporting events of the past few weeks, puts the spotlight back on serious issues down here in Nigeria and the fact that Boko Haram is a real threat. And Boko Haram obviously representing to her, to young Malala, exactly what the people that shot her in Pakistan was against, and that is that education of girls is something that she's very passionate about, and the education of girls is something that just about every Nigerian is quite passionate about, and they want young girls to undergo good quality education, and that's what Boko Haram wants to stop. So perhaps a very poignant meeting, and also very relevant, perhaps at this case in point.
Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. Now, the leaders of Brazil, China, India, Russia and South Africa are meeting in Brazil for a summit of the world's largest emerging economies. The BRICS nations, as they're collectively known, are expected to agree to create a new development bank, which will provide financing for infrastructure projects for developing countries around the world. Starting with $10 billion in cash and a further $40 billion in guarantees, the new bank's reserves are expected to rise to $100 billion. In addition to that, the BRICS leaders will also agree to establish a further $100 billion fund for BRICS member states experiencing financial crisis. For more, I spoke to FSN's Russia correspondent, Jake Rashbass.
So, in a press conference earlier on today, Anton Siluanov, who's Russia's finance minister, confirmed that Russia intends to contribute the equivalent of $2 billion to the bank's reserve over the next 7 years. And that's, of course, a considerable sum. And in the end, Russia will have contributed a total $18 billion, which is the same amount as Brazil and India have pledged to give as well.
And can you explain, Jake, why the BRICS member states decided that this $100 billion fund needs to be established now?
Well, the BRICS member states, as well as other emerging economies around the world, are currently experiencing growth rates that are generally much higher than more developed economies, and it's starting to lead to a bit of skepticism amongst investors. So I spoke earlier to Dmitry Polevoy, who's a chief economist at ING Bank for Russia and the Commonwealth of Independent States, and he explained just why this fund is important, not actually just for the five countries directly involved, but on a global scale.
Currently, investors have a bit more concerns about the sustainability, the growth sustainability in emerging markets, including the BRIC countries. So therefore, the share of thoughts, the share of maybe experience or ideas about how to handle these structural challenges in the economy is also the positive thing, not only for the BRICS economies, but also for the global economy.
And will this sort of cooperation and support between BRICS nations stay on just economic levels, or do you think this cooperation could extend to, say, international political issues as well?
Well, actually, what we've started seeing recently is that that may already be happening. So there seems to be an interesting alignment forming between BRICS member states when it comes to individual member states' foreign policies. So, for example, when the vote was conducted in the UN back in March, where the US sought to invalidate the referendum carried out in Crimea, in which the population voted to join the Russian Federation, all the BRICS member states except Russia, who voted against the motion, abstained from voting, rather than voting in line with the West, who imposed economic sanctions against Russia as a result of the annexation. So yes, it really seems that this cooperation will not stop at an economic level, but will extend into other areas of politics. It's worth considering, though, whether this is so much support for one another as a desire to challenge the dominance of the US on the world stage, At the end of the day, this new development bank will be seen by many as an alternative to the World Bank and the IMF, which is headquartered in the US, and many around the world see it as politically Western-oriented as well. So really, actually, establishing this new bank can be seen as a larger foreign policy strategy amongst the BRIC states to steer global hegemony away from the US.
FSN's Russia correspondent Jake Rashbass. Finally tonight, here's Ollie Barrett with today's edition of FSN Spotlight.
On FSN Spotlight today, remembering Nadine Gordimer. The Nobel Prize-winning author has died in South Africa at the age of 90. She was one of literature's best-known voices against the apartheid regime in South Africa, and she won the Nobel Prize in 1991. She wrote dozens of books, including the novels Burger's Daughter, My Son's Story, and July's People, having published her first story at the age of 15. In 2005, she spoke to Simon Stanford for NobelPrize.org, the official website of the Nobel Prize. He started by asking Nadine Gordimer about her background.
My mother came from England, and my father came from Latvia. Almost every white person for perhaps a generation, two generations, even three generations before, they come from various parts of Europe. And so mine is not the background, it's just one of a number.
And what was the sense during your youth, during your childhood? Did you get a sense that you were part of an elite that owned South Africa?
Oh, it went without saying, if you could call what my background was an elite. It was a small gold mining town. But of course, being white in South Africa, up until the change came, until we got our freedom, to be white was to be automatically belonging to the ruling caste, no matter how humble you were as a white.
Do you think that once you began to recognize that injustice, that humiliation, you began to sort of piece together a more three-dimensional picture of black South Africans as opposed to the many South Africans who either supported or ignored apartheid, who never really let black people come into focus as real people to them?
Yes, but I think you have to look at the circumstances. It was unthinkable for me to meet or know black people who would share my interests, with whom, in other words, there could be some sort of natural rapport and meeting. It was always on the servant-master basis, and even if you were the child of the master and the mistress, you still had this particular position. But being troubled about it, and beginning, great reader as I always was, beginning to find out that there was something called racism that existed in the world, and I was living in it, I was part of it. And then when I was older and went very briefly to, took the train every day and went to the university, and there for the first time I met, even then there were one or two, there were a few young blacks. Remember, the university of course was whites only, but there were certain courses that were not available in the black universities, and then as a concession at graduate level, postgraduate level, few blacks would come in. And so I met one or two black people with whom I had far more in common than I had with the young whites that I knew in the town. I was not I wasn't sporty. Many of the things that they did were of not particular interest to me. And here were young people, black, who were trying to write, who were beginning to write. So we had this enormous not just ambition, we had this enormous approach to life and the mystery of life and social questions in our own lives. And then I began at that age to make black friends. And then as I myself became a young published writer, I moved into a different circle, which was journalists, actors, people who in the arts who normally indeed don't follow the rules, the conservative rules, and where the feeling about the incredible distortions of racism not only the oppression of blacks, but the distortions in your personality, in your mind as a white. These became very much part of my life, and indeed started my way to freedom from racism, from racist ideas that I'd been inculcated at school, at home, everywhere since childhood.
You describe yourself as a natural writer. If perhaps some of those other people that you met were also natural writers.
Yes.
What, you know, there was the recognition of the injustice. There must have been the anger that you felt. What nurtured and fed your voice?
Well, I suppose that did. And then, of course, it meant that this extended to the times when people who said what they thought got into trouble. And if you were black, the consequences were dire. So that your connections, which had been personal and through the arts, became political. And your friends got into trouble. And you found yourself having to indeed, when questioned by the police, to tell lies, to say that you hadn't seen them or you didn't know them. Apartheid made a fantastic liar out of everybody who was against it. You had to, in order to your friends and others to survive, never mind yourself. So that the two really then developed together.
To get back to the Nobel Prize, tell us about it. I mean,
1991.
What was the, did you get a phone call? You knew that you were on the shortlist. What was the procedure?
Well, I've been on the shortlist for a few years, as you usually are, I think. And journalists would phone me and say, you're on the shortlist, you're probably going to get the Nobel Prize. What do you think about it? And I would say, if I ever get it, I'll tell you. Goodbye, and put down the phone. Finished. And on this occasion, I happened to be in New York for another reason and staying with my son. And I got up before anybody else did in the apartment because I wanted to call somebody in London, and with the time difference, you know, it was convenient. But as I went into the kitchen where the phone was, the phone rang. And indeed, it was a Swedish journalist who had found out through a friend in Sweden where I was and phoned to tell me that I'd got the prize. So that was really out of the blue, because I think that year, probably because I was away, no one had phoned and said, you're on the shortlist again.
And I mean, how did that feel? How has that affected your life?
Well, of course, it's a wonderful thing to get, because it is the premier prize in the world.
Does that give extra force to your voice? You get a bigger readership, you get the recognition?
You know, it's a very moot point about readership. Probably the readership thing is for the year when you get it, for the most recent book. But then after that, you know, it's a line on a cover. I don't think it makes all that much difference. But changing your life, you mentioned it gets you, of course it gives you a voice, shall we say, that is likely to be listened to a bit more.
That's Nadine Gordimer, South African Nobel Prize winning author, talking to Simon Stanford for NobelPrize.org in 2005. She's died in Johannesburg at the age of 90. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Ollie Barrett.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Report. Coming up on Tuesday, we're in Italy as the vast salvage operation for the stricken cruise liner, the Costa Concordia, continues. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Nina Maria Potts on the bulletin desk. For everyone, with FSN everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.